I'm Larry Rasmussen, and this is the second session on abortion and focusing especially upon the moral dimensions in the present abortion debate. Yesterday, for those of you who are new today and for bringing us all on board again, we talked of several things. Spent a little time with some factual matters. Who is it that seeks abortions? What is the ratio of live abortions to live births in the United States, which is about one abortion for every live birth today of those reported legal, one to every three of reported legal abortions and reported births. We talked a little bit about the wording of the proposed law that's in the Senate now in committee, and the proposed constitutional amendment. We located the significant Supreme Court decision and talked a little bit about that, Roe versus Wade. And we talked about certain theological claims that I contended add up to two things for our discussing abortion. One, those theological claims provide a kind of framework for our discussing abortion as Christians. We can only discuss abortion within a certain context that talks about life as a gift of God, life as having a derivative dignity and respect about it because it is created good. Special care seen in Jesus for that life which is weak, mute, ill or otherwise cannot attain to its own flourishing. And we talked about the nature of human nature as including a kind of creative freedom that is in fact behind a lot of the technological developments that make for some of the special cases of abortion these days. Then the second thing we said about those theological claims, in addition to providing a kind of context or framework, was that as far as I could tell, they established a kind of burden of proof for our discussion of abortion questions. By that, I meant to say that carrying a fetus to term is not placed on the same, isn't given the same weight as choices for abortion. Rather, the assumption is in favor of carrying a fetus to term. If there is an exception to that, and well there may be, in the case of abortion, that exception needs a special justification, so that the theological bent places a burden of proof or tilts carrying of normal fetus to term. Today, I want to move into what I am fully aware is the controversial and highly... Jorsted was here earlier in the summer. He teaches American studies. He has been a historian of recent American history, and especially that history which comes out of the religious movements in the United States. His contention is that the abortion issue is the most divisive issue in American society since slavery. If you want to divide Americans, this is the one that stands the best chance of doing that. And in point of fact, the largest gatherings in Washington, D.C. since the Vietnam War have been gatherings around the question of abortion. I'm talking about rallies now on one side or the other. And congresspeople will tell you that the volume runs heaviest in their mail on matters of abortion. So I am well aware that this is a highly charged issue. Last night's news included the announcement from the White House that next week President Reagan will address the nation on several social issues, and included among them is abortion. So it's probably particularly timely that we pick this up again. What I would like to do is the following: provide some elements for our deliberation here. Begin by sharing with you some things which I think are critical elements on that question of the taking of human life, so that we have some things to work with. Again, the purpose is the clarification of our own mind. Insofar as I sketch my own reflection on this question, then, it is for the purpose not of convincing you that that is the proper point of view, but for the purpose of letting you know what I see, anyway, as essentials to the discussion itself. My own contention is that abortion is the taking of a form of life that is genetically or biologically human. Now, I phrase that with some care. It is the taking of a form of life that is genetically or biologically human. I didn't say the taking of the life of a person. I didn't even say the taking of a human life. I said the taking of a form of life that is genetically human. The reason I formulate it that way is not to close the debate, but to try to keep it open, to try to say something which is empirically significant, and I think morally significant as well, but to keep the debate open. That definition means that abortion is always morally serious, as far as I can see, because it is the taking of a form of biologically human life. It's not morally serious simply because it's of the presence of human genes in a living cell. All our cells carry the full load of genetic knowledge. All of our cells are human. We don't call it murder when we get a haircut or when one of these mosquitoes takes some blood from us. So it's not morally serious because living human cells have died. At least we don't think it's terribly serious when we don't think the mosquito has killed a person when it has taken some of our cells. It is morally serious because potentially a human life is present in the fertilized egg. I have put on the board what may or may not be helpful set of distinctions. How might one talk about the word person? You can talk about an actual person, you and I. One can talk about someone who has the capacity for personhood, but that's been blocked temporarily. Someone who's, say, in a coma or is unconscious has capacity for personhood, but it has been rendered temporarily, anyway, inoperative. One can talk about a potential person, not yet an actual person, but that would be the expectation given a normal course of development. And I'm saying abortion is morally serious because one is talking, in any event, about a potential person. Given the normal course of development, this fertilized human egg will result in the birth of someone who will be an actual person. And then the last one, possible person, meaning that under the right conditions, a potential person might come about. That is to say, egg and sperm. That's possible. It's not potential until fertilization has happened. So that first contention, that abortion is the taking of a form of life that is genetically human and that it is morally serious because we are talking about potential person. Secondly, I would hold to a developmental view of the fetus. And when I say developmental, I mean not only talking about biological development, but a view that says there is a kind of a developmental view of moral seriousness involved. Put it this way, abortion is morally even more serious later in fetal development than earlier in fetal development. That's what I mean by a developmental view, from a moral point of view. Let me describe some stages. They are also the stages at which different people in different traditions have talked about as the stages when human life sets in. Significant stages: fertilization or conception, implantation after some days, the implantation of the fertilized egg. One reason why some people are very alarmed at the wording in the present proposed constitutional amendment and law is that it would say that use of an IUD or other abortions that prevent implantation means that the person who uses that might possibly be guilty of murder. It depends on what legislation would follow that. But implantation is a significant stage for the biological development of the fetus. Some people say that implantation is morally a very significant stage as well. A time when one can recognize human form in the fetus, about 6 weeks generally. Now, one day we had a meeting of our advisory group. That's seminary students. All the seminary students belong in advisory groups, and we get together once a week. And a student friend, Rhonda, was just very excited. She was pregnant, and she came with a book that showed what the fetus looked like at that point. And for her, it was emotionally and even morally significant that now had reached the point where one could distinguish a human shape. For her, somehow at that moment, we were talking about a human being. Quite apart from the scientific question, at least there was a conviction that here, at this time, we're talking about something that had passed a certain kind of threshold. And I have received in the mail literature from various groups on abortion, usually an ad that's run in the paper showing a picture of a tiny fetus, but the picture is taken when the fetus shows a human form, usually about as soon as it does. So that somehow is, for many people, a morally significant stage in fetal development. Another significant stage for, again, different people and for physicians, of course, all of these are medically and developmentally significant, time of quickening, when you feel the fetus, when you distinguish the movement. A fifth stage, viability, when it's possible for the fetus to maintain life outside the mother's womb. And then sixth, it's not the birth itself. End, of course, of fetal development, and one would not be talking about abortion at that point, but of something else if death took place. I want us to be very clear that the constitutional amendment and the proposed Hyde-Helms bill both say there isn't a difference. There is not a difference between aborting by such as an IUD before implantation of the fertilized egg and the death at the time of birth. That morally, those are on the same level. In both cases, and in all cases along this path of development, it is a person that is being killed in the eyes of the law, according to this bill and this proposed amendment, which, again to clarify the situation, is sharply in contrast with the Supreme Court decision, which is undecided, evidently, about when life begins, or if they are, that's not altogether clear from the decision. In any event, they say that for at least for the first trimester of pregnancy, we're not talking about the life of a person in the eyes of the law. So there's a very significant difference morally between the legislation now proposed and the stand of the Supreme Court. I think that most people do in fact hold a developmental view. That doesn't make it right. And one thing you don't do in ethics is say, because everybody's doing it or thinking it, that makes it right. So I'm not trying to draw that conclusion here. Even if we say it somehow might be significant if everyone did hold that point of view. The reason I say that is because even people who are very outspoken that it is the death of a person that's involved during an abortion at any stage usually shrink from the consequences of that point of view. If you ask someone who said abortion is murder because it's the taking of the life of a person, no matter what stage, if you ask that person the question, have you ever suffered or have you ever known someone who has suffered a natural abortion, a miscarriage? And then you ask the next question after they've said yes, did you or was a funeral service arranged? Or a burial arranged? And they say no, then you say, why? And for a lot of people, at least intuitively, the response is, well, we're not dealing with a human being in the case of a miscarriage. So I think that for most people, at least intuitively, there is some significant development from early stages of abortion to later stages with respect to dealing with the life of a human being. That some significant distance somehow is traveled from conception to birth. The question that we all wrestle with is this one. When, then, does humanity set in? Now, there are lots of traditions on that, and whether or not they're helpful, I'll let you decide, but we should be aware of them. Thomas Aquinas, a great Roman Catholic theologian, his position on abortion was as follows. Human life sets in at the time of quickening. Most Roman Catholics don't know that, incidentally. For Aquinas, it's when you feel movement that you're dealing with the life of a human being. So here, Aquinas, the greatest Roman Catholic theologian, didn't oppose earlier abortions in some instances. Others have said that the human life is present from the beginning. Many of these many of the people that hold this point of view or held this point of view did so on the basis of a biology that was carried over from Aristotle, and it was prevalent in the later Middle Ages. That Aristotelian biology was of the conviction that the sperm contains, in effect, just a teeny-weeny little human being. It's what you had in the sperm was just a minuscule person in presence, and that the egg was the incubator. Now, there's a bit of male chauvinism involved here. that the male is the bearer of life, and the woman supplies the proper conditions for it to go on. But there really was the conviction that in the sperm you were dealing with a tiny, tiny, tiny little human being. And so obviously that meant the death of that. By contrast, for a lot of Hebrews, and it carried on in the Jewish tradition, and I even know Jews who feel this way today, human life really begins at birth. The reason for that is that the essence of being human is a capacity for relationship. And that capacity isn't present until one is physically present among other human beings. So that tradition of relationality is the key to being human. In fact, in Hebrew notions, a good Old Testament notion is that there's a kind of very full understanding of what is life and what is death. And if people have no longer the capacity to offer praise, they are as good as dead. It's even talked about in terms of death. So relationality is kind of a minimal, although essential, element in being human. And so in the Hebrew tradition, birth is the decisive moment. Well, you wouldn't find a lot of people that said that now, and indeed probably does reflect patriarchal society. Yeah. Others have said it's that when humanity sets in, and the significant way is at the time of viability. That is when this one can exist outside the mother, and then. The point at which I mentioned to you that was so real for our friend at seminary, when the fetus has recognizable human form. Let's make sure that we've got some time for discussion. What I want to do now is fudge and not come at the question by trying to answer that question, when does human life set in, rather come at the question by taking another approach and ask a question. Why do we protect human life? Why do we do that? When I ask students that, they think I'm dumb, and they invariably say, well, obviously, killing is hazardous to your health. That's why. And that's supposed to end the discussion, but if the bell hasn't rung, I press them. But why? Why is killing hazardous to your health? Then they're sure I'm really dumb. I just want to go through some of the reasons and see if it provides any illumination for us. Of course, killing is the greatest of all dangers to the victim. But why? Some of the reasons are these. The knowledge of a threat to life is a cause for great anguish or great suffering for the victim. To know that one's life is in jeopardy is the occasion of great suffering in and of itself. That's one reason. The fear of death is already a kind of violence. Another reason is that, of course, the taking of life itself doesn't always have to, but it can entail great suffering. Another good reason why society ought to protect life. A third one, the experience of life, once it has begun, is or it can be or so precious, so unique, so valuable that no one who has the experience should be further deprived of it, shouldn't cut someone off from that which is of great value. So I've put these in short form on the board. Another reason, too, everything that has already been experienced as precious is gone with death, or at least we suspect that may be the case. Death cuts off not only the future for the victim, but death prevents the continued experience of a precious past by way of memory. Another reason why you'd give for protecting life is that the killing is brutalizing for the one who does it. It's dehumanizing for those who carry out the act of killing. the family of the victim and others often, usually, experience great grief and great loss. So you protect life so that you do not entail suffering for family and friends. And then lastly, or not necessarily lastly, the seven that I came up with, all of society has some stake in the protection of life. It is permitting killing to occur can set patterns that may well be harmful and threatening to others who are not even in that group. If you decide, as it was decided in Nazi Germany, that certain groups are less than human and are dispensable to society, that is a threat to those folks, of course, but it's also a threat potentially to all kinds of other folks in society. So all of life has a stake in it. These are seven reasons that one might give for the protection of life. They come, incidentally, from an article by Sissela Bok, B-O-K, in the Hastings Report. If some of you want that bibliographical data, I can give that to you later. I mention these because we readily say, and rightly say, that it's wrong to kill, although we often add an except after that, such as self-defense, or war, or in cases of committing of certain crimes. But we usually will say that somehow killing is intrinsically wrong, and it's not a morally insignificant question to ask. Why is that morally wrong? There are some reasons, and you can say, well, all these are obvious reasons. It's just a matter of common sense. Maybe so, but now let's take them to the matter of abortions and ask how they pertain for abortions at different stages, if you held to a developmental view of the fetus. Let's start by talking about the conditions for the zygote, for the fertilized egg in its very earliest stages. How do these reasons look? Well, as best we can tell, the zygote does not have consciousness. At that point, it cannot experience fear. The first one, then, would not pertain. That is, that a knowledge of a threat to my life causes anguish and suffering. For the fertilized egg in its earlier stages, that wouldn't, as best we know, be the case. As best we can tell, there isn't suffering entailed in the actual destruction of the zygote. If a miscarriage occurred at that very early period, as is often the case, we don't usually think, or we don't think that that has been a suffering experience for the fertilized egg. If a fertilized egg failed to implant, which also happens, we don't regard that death as being an agonizing one for that fertilized egg, a suffering end to life. So that the second one would not pertain at that stage. The third reason up here, the zygote hasn't experienced life as we know it, so is not conscious of the loss of a valuable future. Is not conscious of the loss, the next point, of a valued past. It doesn't have any. So that would not pertain. In this very earliest stage, human bonds of affection between the zygote and the mother and the father, the potential parents, aren't yet developed. So family and family's friends do not suffer grievously from the egg's death, although I'm not saying that miscarriage can't be. It often isn't a traumatic experience. But it isn't, in the earliest very stages, at least by degree, you haven't had the kind of emotional nurture, outpouring of time, energy, and selves that would be the case later in the whole development. Usually the death of a zygote would not be brutalizing for the medical staff. For example, the doctor who okays the use of an intrauterine device is not caught up in something which is experienced as brutalizing or dehumanizing, even though it results in the death of a fertilized egg. Or the medical personnel who attend someone who's had an early miscarriage. There's a lot of care and concern, but there isn't the kind of suffering that is entailed in the death of a human person involved. The death of the zygote isn't usually regarded as a threat to human beings in society. So these questions that we give for the protection of life, it seems to me, may be helpful in thinking about abortions at different stages. Now, there are nonetheless some factors which are held in common between abortions at early stages and killing of humans of born humans, two of them for sure. One is the deprivation of potential, a denial of a future. A second is the presence of a common biological humanity, that we are dealing with one of our own kind, whether it's a zygote or whether it's a bouncing baby. Those two reasons, the deprivation of potential and the presence of a common biological humanity, at least for me, means that abortion at every stage is morally serious. They put abortion at a long distance from the notion, for example, that removing fetal tissue is analogous to having one's tonsils out or appendix, as if this tissue were on the same level as other tissue. I would myself conclude that the presence of those two factors means that any abortion is not a good. It would be spoken of at best as a lesser evil over against something else, but never as a good and as a choice equal with other choices at the point of choices of birth control. It seems to me that those two reasons would make this means of birth control, if it was looked to for that, quite different and morally more serious than some other kinds. At the same time, early abortion would, in my view, not be the same as murder. The reasons for protecting life do not pertain to the same degree for early abortions as they do for birthed human beings. That's a point where we can discuss at great length. If one moves closer, as one moves closer and closer to the stage of viability, then the protection of life becomes increasingly compelling. For example, if you're talking about a viable fetus, let's just move down the period of the 9 months. The viable fetus could experience pain and death, though probably not yet fear. The death of the viable fetus could be brutalizing to those who carry out the killing. It could certainly be of great anguish to family and others. It might be a threat to all in society who might be found to be, for whatever reasons, undesirable. That is, society has a stake in this. Well, I'm just going to post that because I want to finish here and leave us time to discuss. One more, and this is just an aside, on societal attitudes. It isn't the case that there's a one-to-one relationship between the attitudes toward abortion in society and the attitudes toward care of living human beings. It isn't a one-to-one relationship. Scandinavia, for example, probably has the world's most exemplary care of the unwanted child and of what I earlier called the weak and the mute. Probably Scandinavia does more for, say, genetically deformed and genetically diseased children than any other group of countries. At the same time, early abortions are very common and are legal in Scandinavia, also medically safe. By contrast, Nazi Germany held a terrible idolization of death, and whole classes of people were defined as expendable, but abortion was strictly forbidden in Nazi Germany. Now, I'm not trying to draw any particular relationships. I just want to say it's more complex than we sometimes imagine. So that we can get, as we talked about yesterday, you can get a pattern where some of the same people who favor a constitutional amendment on abortion might favor or might reject a ban on handguns and favor capital punishment and favor a huge increase in militarism. At the same time, you can get people who are very much against abortion, who are ardent pacifists on all of those things. So it's just a complex kind of relationship and not a single one-to-one relationship. Okay, I'll finish by saying what might be a set of classes of possibly justified abortion. If abortion is always morally serious because it's the taking of a form of biologically human life and is the taking of the life of a potential person, are there ever exceptions to the rule that the fetus should develop to term, is the way I want to put the question. Are there ever exceptions to that rule? I see some possibilities where the justification might meet the burden of proof. One, in the case of involuntary pregnancies. Now, a note from yesterday, the contention was that proper moral reasoning says you use the same moral norms for justifying your basic stance as you do for justifying any exceptions to that. So if I said there are some cases of morally justified abortions, I'm going to have to say it's on the same ground as the reasons that you would say the fetus ought to be carried to term. Don't be distracted by someone who needs the afternoon nap here. I just took a nap before I came to the session. This is the person that didn't. That's fine. Involuntary pregnancy might be a case of justifiable abortion because it is destructive of the woman's dignity and is part of her dignity, her autonomy. Rape, the power relationships of incest might be examples. It's doubtful to me that we should ever force bodily support upon another person, in this case the fetus, if that other person did not will that support in the first place or carry any intrinsic responsibility for it. That is, if it's totally involuntary pregnancy, I don't think that one can offer morally justified reasons for forcing a person to carry bodily support to something where that support has not been freely given. Now, that's different from the cases where a person said, we never intended pregnancy to result, because you were carrying, there's always that chance, and you were carrying responsibility for it, and it was, the intercourse was at least voluntary, but we're talking about involuntary intercourse that results in involuntary pregnancy. A second case might be cases of enormous suffering for all involved. I won't go through this. If my spouse was here, she could tell you of cases of enormous suffering, as in the case of a Tay-Sachs child, where death is certain, great suffering for the child, great suffering for the parents, brutalizing to helping professionals in the healthcare society, very hard even on society at large. Nyla was taking care of a teenager who was pregnant. The teenager was herself sick, but she had a disease of the nervous system that assuredly meant the fetus would develop in a grossly abnormal way and die very soon after birth. And it was brutalizing, would have been brutalizing for all, including that then child. The fetus probably would have lived to the point of birth, but not long thereafter. So maybe cases of enormous suffering for all, where those norms of dignity, respect, compassion, etc., would be entailed also for the fetus, as well as others involved. Third, cases where two lives are in basic physical conflict, and maybe mental conflict. There we've got to talk about particular cases where the health of the fetus and the physical and psychic health of the mother are clearly in conflict with one another. Might be a case. Here one would say that relationships which are already existent and expressive of life's goodness and life's dignity and care for others are relationships that should be protected if you have two sets of relationships in conflict with one another. I don't think that you would regard as equal the moral claims of the early fetus and the moral claims of the mother, though both are very serious when the two are in basic conflict with one another. Maybe, and we're getting, to me, fuzzier and fuzzier as we go along, maybe cases where any minimal quality of life is highly unlikely. The toughest one for me on this is the case of abortion in some countries and among some peoples where you have a setting of chronic and simply unrelenting poverty, where the care for the child in terms of any kind of quality of life is very unlikely given what we know of the past, even decades of the past. And I would not regard early abortions as preferable or as any kind of good here, but it may be a lesser evil. Now, you should not expect agreement here. Mother Teresa was recently in Washington and testified in the Hill on abortions, and her contention was that one, abortions were a destruction of the image of God in humanity. And she says the poor do not have abortions, and if some of them are getting them, they should not. So you have someone whose testimony is from one who works constantly with the poor, who would take a very different view from the one that I expressed as possible. There are other cases. Some of the tough ones are ones around how important should a social movement be in giving reasons for abortions. Right now, you have a lot of justifiable reaction by women against male domination that's gone on for centuries, and the women will say, it is our decision whether or not to have an abortion. And under the rubric of justified statement of women's rights, then the decision is to be left to the woman. That's the one I find more difficult, but certainly is an important one. Okay, let me just stop there. I think our time for discussion can go any way you want it. I would hope that we could at least just stay to the general topic of those moral issues around abortion as a taking of life that is at least biologically human, and then tomorrow we will go on to that other set of moral issues about the relationship between abortion and public policy, even after we've decided where we stand on this question of the taking of human life. That doesn't of itself answer the question, what ought the law to be? Because there are a lot of other factors that come into question there. What makes for a good law? What makes for enforceable law? Etc., etc. And we Americans are so I was going to say schizophrenic. I don't know if you can be schizophrenic in a three-way direction, can you? We, sometimes we're Puritans, and we say that every sin ought to be a crime. So our response to something that we feel is wrong is, there ought to be a law. Other times we're pietists, and we say, you can't legislate morality. And it's just exactly the opposite of the Puritan response. And you say, so basic moral choices are really up to the individuals and their own sense of responsibility. You can't legislate morality. And then other times we're utter anarchists and we say, these sorts of things, the government ought not to be involved in. It's up to every individual to make up his or her own mind. So tomorrow's session is going to be interesting because we're going to have Puritans and pietists and anarchists. And they're not only going to be in the room here as different persons, some of us are all three at the same time. But let's leave that for tomorrow. Yes. Would you be satisfied if I put an eighth one where you would say and others would say killing is intrinsically wrong, quite apart from these reasons? And then when one asked why is it so, you would say, well, the grounding is in being created by God and bearing the image of God. I mean, I would do with you just as with others, sort of press, you know, what are the foundational reasons? But I think one could put here, killing is intrinsically wrong. I find though when you press that, people end up giving these other reasons, unless you say no, there's a reverence that comes with life itself and the death of any kind of life, at least if it's intentional rather than course of natural events, is wrong. Yeah, well, some would go further than that and would not draw the line very sharply between human and non-human life, but we can restrict that to human life because we're talking about abortion. Are there other reasons that you would give to this question of why protect life? Appreciate that addition. How strongly you came down on that would matter. I mean, that's a morally significant item. And that one would be extremely important. It seems to me that would commit one also to being, commit one on some other issues, such as capital punishment, participation in war, such things. And if you argued for exceptions on those others, you would have to go back and say, now does that exception pertain in the matter of abortion? It may or may not. One could say, killing is intrinsically wrong, but for persons who have already taken the lives of others, they are guilty of heinous crime, and that's morally, and their lives should be taken. And then you would say, however, that doesn't pertain to abortion because you're not talking about a guilty party; you're talking about an innocent party in the life of the fetus. So you'd have to go both ways, it seems to me, in moral deliberation. Yeah.
One thing, I guess, that kind of we're talking about protecting life and killing, that I think ties in with some of these exceptions or reasons that possibilities where an abortion would be proper. We're talking about protect life. I think sometimes we stop only at the physical breathing life and don't think about the emotional and intellectual life that that child, you know, that child or potential child may be. We, you know, there have been many cases, for instance, we're talking about the poverty or, you know, a totally unwanted child that, we've protected the physical life, but what kind of a, and, you know, we've been talking in the mornings about a child's self-image and what is going to a child who, you're saving the physical life, but what are you doing to that mental and emotional life? You know, that's killing too, if you want to, that's intrinsically
Yeah, that whole question is a significant one that has to enter in. What about questions of quality? And then how do you reckon those into your moral deliberation? The other thing that needs to go into that, though, is to ask about alternatives in society to abortion in order to handle cases where it looks like the quality of life, even minimal kind of quality, is severely in jeopardy. And John Yoder was here last week. John Yoder speaks out of the pacifist tradition. We didn't have sessions on abortion with John Yoder, but it was quite clear from talking with him that his emphasis would be very rarely would you have justifiable abortions, but society, we, the church, has a great responsibility to finding alternatives to abortions in those cases where the life of the future life of the child shows almost no promise whatsoever of having any anything we would call quality. And by that I mean things such as just basic health and some kind of caring environment. So he would not see quality as a reason for so much justifying abortions, but for the press to find alternatives. And I have very sensitive Roman Catholic friends whose conservatism on abortion is matched by their work themselves for finding alternatives for the children who are unwanted, who will not stay with their biological mother. Yeah.
But there is a big mentality in this country that assumes that every child has, at home,
yeah,
this marvelous mom.
Yeah.
Exactly what to do. Is doing these super duper things for them.
Yeah.
And it's the same mentality you find saying, take care of a go.
Yeah, who aren't working for alternatives at all.
Yeah. See, the difference between what that child would have if he stayed home compared to the quality that he's receiving in the
daycare. Yeah. Or talk to social workers who work with teenage pregnancies and other pregnancies all the time, and they will often be, by contrast with even myself, liberal on questions of abortion, because they just see one case after another where it's just destructive for everyone involved. Yeah.
You've mentioned several things, circumstances under which you consider it morally acceptable to allow an abortion, and I agree with the social workers. I would extend the list that I have seen 12-year-olds delivered who had no idea that intercourse was going to result in a child, and had no more idea than that how to take care of a child.
Yes.
And I've seen middle-aged women who had no more desire for a child and the diaphragm failed, or women who had several young children and had no more need for a child and the IUD failed. And as you've mentioned, people have been raped, and further, 40-year-old women who have pregnancies when they are at risk to have children who have Down syndrome, and there we get into more shady ground again.
Mm-hmm.
But, I personally believe that they should have the option to decide whether abortion would be appropriate for them. And I would make the point that if you're going to say, at what point does life start, that every 28 days a woman has an egg that is capable of being fertilized, and if you go to the absurd extreme, you could say that a woman is not fulfilling her potential if she is not pregnant at all times. And if she does not fertilize an egg, because a
fertilized egg. Someone would like to draw a hard line between potential and possible when you start listing that example. Well, but I assume that your point of view assumes that. I mean, I think that in your list of cases where you would say that abortion is morally justified, that it assumes some picture of the development of the fetus, and that you are designating the word human at some points and not at others. Am I right?
In my personal experience, in my personal mind, I would say that the fetus is human at the point that the decision is made to carry the child to term.
So. I'd like to hear more about that. That's one that I've not encountered here. So that the humanity of the fetus is dependent on the decision of the parent or parents.
I feel that while the capability exists to end the pregnancy as to have prevented the pregnancy, that it's the decision of the woman. You know, my opinion is really colored by the fact that I am a physician.
Yes.
And I have worked with a lot of pregnant young women.
Yes.
Who didn't want to be pregnant, and who, if they had had the proper information about contraception,
mm-hmm.
could have prevented the pregnancy, but they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so here they were stuck in a situation that was really going to change their life a lot and not necessarily for the better. And so I feel very strongly that the option of abortion needs to be present for them.
But if I can just press a little bit, I'm assuming that in addition to that, you are also making a judgment about the fetus itself and the fetus's humanity. As Paul Menzel mentioned yesterday, the Supreme Court decision was not only rendered on the basis of a woman's right to privacy. That was one of the two important elements. The other one was the fact that the Supreme Court was agnostic about whether human life was present in the first trimester, just didn't want to answer that question. If they had answered the question like the proposed constitutional amendment now says, legally a person is present from the moment of conception, then the Supreme Court decision might have said, would have had another factor to weigh, and may have said a woman's right to decide is the only factor, but it would have been significantly different, I think. So am I right that your position is both the experience with teenage pregnancies and a reading of what you see as fetal development and the place of being human in that? I mean, it's the two together, isn't it?
I don't know if I understand your question, but yes, I'd say so.
If you believed that the life of a human being was present from the moment of fertilization, would you hold the same position that you've just articulated?
I believe
now
that a fertilized egg has the capability to become a human being, but I don't believe that is the issue. And I wouldn't call it killing myself.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But you know, in a way, I'm sure you would say I'm putting blinders on and saying, you know, this is true but not this. But I'm looking at it in a non-abstract way. I'm looking at
yes.
it in a very practical
yes.
day-to-day
way. Yeah.
I like her definition, and it sort of explains to me all the three-quarters that work with the behavior of subhuman animal-like patterns. Because they weren't wanted, they weren't human.
Was that, in fact, the dinner bell? That's the one. Well, we will have to end this at least formally. Yesterday, they're not going in yet. Well, let's keep talking until we hear the bell for real. Marge and then Tim.
As church people, I hope that we can talk a little bit more about dealing with attitudes. You know, not only the legal matters, but our task in dealing with attitudes of people. We're going to have to go a long way, for instance, if we start talking about involuntary pregnancy, as long as our attitude that it's usually the woman's fault if she's raped, and that it's her seduction or the kind of clothes she wears, when
yes.
everything, every study indicates
yeah.
that this is 90% of premeditated hostile
act. Yeah.
But I don't hear much talk about that,
yes.
either in classes or from the pulpit.
In fact, in that case, it's much more an act of violence that has not to do with sex.
Oh.
It isn't sexually an act at all. It's much
right.
more an
the
act of straight-out violence. Yeah.
And then I think another thing that bothers me a lot whenever talk of abortion comes up
is the difference in the attitudes of the dominant society toward minority groups.
Mm.
And I think public policy in many countries reflects that.
All kind of double standards.
Yes.
Yeah. And that certainly has been the case in the practice with respect to abortion. Tim?
I was just thinking that more could be done to, or we could reach out to embrace more.